Think again.
A 7-year campaign of harassment had not produced the results prosecutors hoped for. Dustin Hurd, Evan Liberty, Nick Slatin, and Paul Slough still refused to take plea deals and turn on each other. So it was up to their teammates, Jeremy Ridgway, Matt Murphy, Mark Mealy, and Adam Frost, to testify to the story that prosecutors wanted a jury to hear. Some of them got immunity deals. You'll certainly hear those names again when we talk about storytelling. So pay attention. Years later, we asked Kelly Hurd if she wishes Dustin had taken a plea deal instead of going through a trial whose outcome was decided before it started.
No, because as much as this has, this has cost us years, time with his kids, our kids' development, what all of that, this imprisonment has taken a toll, taken away from our kids and our family. But I think it would have been tenfold had he pled guilty just because they were pressuring him, because he would have sacrificed everything that makes him him. He knew they didn't do what he wanted. He knew he followed the rules of engagement.
But what you need to make this into a spectacle instead of a trial is a stooge sitting up there on the bench to help the prosecutors make a case out of nothing. And the DOJ had that in Judge Royce Lamberth. When he wasn't berating the defense attorneys or threatening them with contempt of court and slapping gag orders on everybody, he was sleeping. That's right, sleeping. Let's review what Stacey Hurd and then Reba Slatin said about that in our last episode, just to refresh our recollection.
Right. Okay. So do you, I'm asking this to everybody just because I want to do a little piece on the judge himself. And there were several people who mentioned that he fell asleep during the proceedings.
They said lots of times he would be sitting up there and he'd just doze off. He wasn't listening. They called him sleepy because he would just sit up there and go to sleep.
The judge was terrible. And I know we're not supposed to trash anybody, but he just wasn't allowing I just feel like he wasn't working with the law. I feel like he was emotional, and he would sleep a lot too. Maybe he's sick. I don't know. I think he is sick. Well, actually, they had to take some time off because he was sick from the trial. During the trial, he had to have some procedures and stuff. But I was ashamed that this is Washington, D.C. This is how a courtroom is run in Washington, D.C. It was embarrassing.
We asked the families, the men and their defense attorneys, what they thought would happen. Everybody was certain from the start that this was some kind of political theater, that it would all blow over in a month or so. But as soon as the courtroom door opened and they sat down at the defense table, the shenanigans started. Here's Nick Slatin's mother, Reba, who endured 3 trials.
Prosecution could get away with anything, and our attorneys were very intelligent, very smart. They did a wonderful job, but the judge would shut them down. He wouldn't let them put on a case, really. They did a good job, but I felt like it was a one-sided fight, and they were having to fight the system. It was ridiculous, because the burden of proof, I thought, was supposed to be for the prosecution, and they didn't really have to do anything. The judge just didn't seem to go by what I thought the law was.
We begin with one of the most unusual and lengthy criminal court battles you may ever hear about.
It was one of the worst killings of innocent civilians by U.S. contractors in Iraq.
four guards claimed they were ambushed while escorting diplomatic officials.
Washington convicted four former Blackwater security guards in the 2007 shootings and killings of dozens of unarmed Iraqis.
From Think Again Studios, this is Raven 2-3, Presumption of Guilt. I'm Gina Keating. Reba Slatin was right. Judge Royce Lamberth left the planet right away by deciding he didn't believe the Military Extraterritorial Jurisdiction Act, or MEJA. That's the law that lets U.S. courts prosecute military contractors for crimes committed overseas. Unfortunately for the government, the law states that only military contractors who accompany the U.S. military or have a mission supporting the Defense Department fell under the law. Blackwater's contract was with the Department of State, not the DOD. Dustin Hurd, Evan Liberty, Nick Slatin, and Paul Slough were not supporting soldiers. They were diplomatic bodyguards. The delineation was so clear to the Defense Department that Gordon England, the Deputy Secretary of Defense, wrote about it in a 2007 letter to Senator Barack Obama, and then testified at trial that the Raven 2-3 men did not ever work for or support the mission of the DOD. Thus, the Nisser Square case never fell under MEJA. It literally could not legally be prosecuted in the United States or anywhere else.
If I believed that statute, I would have to throw out this case.
So now judges get to decide if they believe the laws? What? But just in case the jury actually believed MEJA or Gordon England's testimony, Judge Lamberth muddied the waters by refusing to read them a statute showing that it's the State Department, not the Defense Department, that's in charge of providing diplomatic security. Lamberth definitely put points on the board for the prosecution with his MEJA rulings, but he was going to have to pull out all the stops to overcome the problems in the case. There is a wealth of evidence that the Raven 2-3 convoy was engaged in a gun battle with insurgents just moments after it entered Nisser Square on September 16, 2007. Remember what our defense attorney, Joseph Lowe, told us. Fear for your life or somebody else's life is a complete defense against murder and manslaughter charges. And as we've explained, there were piles of shell casings that proved this was a gun battle. So what's a prosecutor to do about that? The short answer is you hide evidence. You destroy it. You pretend it never existed. You coach your witnesses to lie. You destroy the defendant's reputation with the help of the press. Yes, this actually happened in a United States federal courtroom. What happened in the Raven 2-3 case is not rare. It's the path our criminal justice system has been traveling for a long time. And why not? Joseph Lowe, a former U.S. Marine, member and instructor in the Judge Advocate General Corps, a criminal defense attorney for 20 years, and head of the Elite Trial Lawyers College, tells us why cheating pays for prosecutors.
The government passed some rules a while ago that said that they are not accountable for abuses of the enormous power that we have given them in the field of criminal defense or removing your freedom. And so just theoretically or philosophically, whenever you give someone a lot of power and there is no consequence to the abuse of it, well, then you have ensured that that's exactly what's going to happen, especially if they get promoted and heralded and their careers advance for being able to do what you are reportedly paying them to do, which is to get a conviction. Remember, no prosecutor has ever been singled out, given an award, promoted, made statue of for dismissing a case or for losing it.
That is the key. Power with no consequences. So rather than go through the minutiae of all three trials, let's talk about how these three trials went wrong. Please hang with us for this explanation because it is the most important thing to take away from this podcast. This stuff happens every day in American courts. If you get hung up on the fact that these men worked for a private contractor in an unpopular war Ask yourself, would it scare the hell out of me to be treated this way by my own government? We're pretty sure you'll come to the same conclusion we did. In a show trial, the only rules are the ones the government invents, and it can portray civil rights violations as a series of harmless errors with the help of a compliant judge. A series of harmless errors is exactly what Patrick Martin and Judge Lamberth called the list of crimes against the defendants that we're going to explore right now. They're called Brady violations, and one of them is usually enough to have a case thrown out. In the Raven 2-3 cases, there have been at least five major Brady violations that should have resulted in a new trial or dismissal of the case. Each time, Judge Lamberth blew off the defense team's objections and let the case go forward. So let's rewind to what Joseph Lowe said about Brady violations.
Can you tell me what a Brady violation is, just for people who don't understand
what it is? Yes. What it stands for is a rule of law which says that prior to a trial of a defendant or defendants, the government is required to give to the defense all exculpatory and even potentially exculpatory information. And usually, specifically, it deals with those witnesses that will be testifying against the defendants. So when there is an accusation of a Brady violation, what it means is the government had potentially exculpatory evidence in their possession that they failed to provide to the defense prior to trial.
The key is proving that a Brady violation could have changed the outcome of a trial. Remember, the DOJ was claiming that these men fired at unarmed civilians without provocation. So is it an unfortunate error or a game changer when prosecutors fail to turn over photographs of enemy shell casings in Nisr Square on the day of the shooting? These photographs magically turned up just as Army Captain Peter Decaro took the stand and testified about taking the photos and handing them over to Army investigators. That was 8 weeks into a 10-week trial. That material evidence of enemy gunfire directly contradicted the government's theory of the case. It also gave the Raven 2-3 defendants an absolute defense against the murder and manslaughter charges against them. Remember, if you fear for your life or the life of another, you have every right to use force to defend yourself. Defense attorney Joseph Lowe says the case should have ended right there.
If the violation is analyzed by the appellate court and it is one where the evidence could have, and this is kind of the language I use, could have allowed a reasonable jury or a jury to reasonably reach a different conclusion, then you have to do the trial over.
Not only did Paul, Dustin, Nick, and Evan not get a new trial, but they had to sit silently at the defense tables while the prosecutors suborned perjury from the Iraqi witnesses. Suborning perjury means knowingly inducing witnesses to lie under oath. And the defense attorneys told me they were terrified to vigorously cross-examine these witnesses for fear of looking unsympathetic, or even worse, pissing off Judge Lamberth. They were forced to use the same playbook as the prosecutors that Judge Lamberth instantly decided he hated in his now infamous Department of the Interior case. Here's an actor reading from an article by Richard Pierce, a law professor at George Washington University, entitled Judge Lamberth's Reign of Terror at the Department of the Interior.
In the early stages of the case, the government's lawyers and their bosses hoped they could demonstrate their good faith to the judge by acquiescing in all his actions, even though they believed many were illegal.
So, for example, the defense hardly challenged the list of victims or inconsistencies in their stories. Some hadn't even been in Nisr Square that day. Death certificates for others showed the wrong dates. One man on the list was shot several miles from Nisr Square, and the father of one little boy who died claimed in a local news report that his son was killed by a U.S. Army shooter in a different incident. The defense attorneys thought they'd caught a break with Brady violation number two. During sentencing, a key prosecution witness, an Iraqi police officer named Sarhan Monim, radically changed his testimony. This man testified for 3 days in a row. He said he was the closest Iraqi police officer to the convoy, so he's not a fringe player in this drama. During trial, Officer Monim testified that he approached the white Kia after the first shots were fired. He said he found the driver dead. But after the verdict, Monim wrote in a victim impact statement that he never left his police kiosk because he was paralyzed with fear. He wrote that he could hear the Kia driver pleading with his mother to get out of the car after the first shots were fired. Prosecutors turned over that statement to the defense 3 weeks after Monim made it, and just 5 days before the sentencing hearing. It was buried at the bottom of a stack of documents. So let's go over this again. Monim first testified that he saw bullets from the Raven 2-3 convoy hit the Kia driver and his mother. Next, Monim says he saw nothing. In fact, he said he could hear the woman and her son debating about whether to get out of the car after the first shots were fired. This admission destroys the government's entire theory that the driver was shot and killed instantly in an ambush attack. Rather, it shows the driver and his mother were caught in the middle of a firefight and trying to escape. The law requires the government to immediately disclose material changes in witness testimony to the defense. So, what did Judge Lambert do when the defense confronted him about this second harmless error? That's another unbelievable tale. Judge Lambert held a closed-door hearing with just the prosecutors and Monim. I repeat, Lambert did not let the defense attorneys attend this hearing. And then he decided that the radical change in Monim's testimony was not important and could not have affected the trial's outcome.
The court finds that Monim did not provide perjurious testimony at the trial of this matter. Further finds that in any new trial, Monim's victim impact statement could be used as merely impeaching material and would further finds that in any new trial, the introduction or use of Monim's victim impact statement would probably not produce an acquittal.
Not so fast, Your Honor. Here's what the National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers said in their amicus brief about this error.
Although this statement submitted to the court itself triggered a host of questions, the district court refused to inquire further, denying the appellant's new trial motion without holding a hearing and without even directing an inquiry into the contradictory and incongruous statements. That cannot possibly be the proper way for a district court to respond.
Judge Lambert didn't respond any differently to Brady violation number 3, the missing drone footage, the prosecution's very own version of the Watergate tapes. The government had in its possession satellite images and about 10 minutes of footage taken by a U.S. Army drone in the aftermath of the gun battle in Nisr Square. The prosecutors knew about this footage at least as early as 2009. We know this because they asked the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency to evaluate the images and footage. At trial, they played just 46 seconds of that footage. 4 minutes from the beginning and 6 minutes from the end of the drone footage had mysteriously gone missing. That missing footage could have confirmed what witnesses testified to: Iraqi gunmen throwing aside their weapons and fake police uniforms as they fled the square. Iraqi gunmen shooting at the convoy from a bus shelter south of the circle. Iraqi police sanitizing the scene by picking up AK-47 shell casings. But none of that footage survived. The defense did not file a new trial motion on this patched-together evidence, but the fact that Judge Lambert just let it slide is another example of his incorrigible bias, just like in the Department of the Interior case. Would the jury have decided differently if it had seen the full moving picture of what happened in Nisr Square that day? His position was supposed to be as a neutral arbiter of fact, not a cheerleader for the prosecution. For Brady violation number 4, we return to the theme of corrupt witnesses, but this is a big one. Remember how the number two man at the U.S. Embassy in Baghdad, Robert Ford, told us that the Iraqi National Police conducted the criminal investigation into Nasser Square. So why did that lead investigator never testify at trial? In a typical American criminal case, the lead investigator will testify about the collection and handling of evidence, the chain of custody, and the conclusions reached. The DOJ actually flew that Iraqi investigator out to the United States to testify in the first trial in 2014, and then mysteriously sent him back to Baghdad without calling him to the stand. It wasn't until Nick Slatton's legal team went on a fishing expedition before his second trial in 2018 and caught a whopper that the defense learned why the government was so desperate to hide this guy. This is what the defense asked for on February 2nd, 2018.
All information, including files of intelligence agencies, regarding whether any of the Iraqi police at Nasser Square on September 16, 2007, or any of the Iraqi police who participated in the Nasser Square investigation have any suspected connection or affiliation with any insurgent or terrorist group.
You can see this one coming a mile away. Remember, the government has a constitutional obligation to produce anything that's helpful to the defendant. So, of course, the government at first says it can neither confirm nor deny whether such information exists. 4 months later, prosecutors filed a summary with the court that named none other than the lead Iraqi investigator, Colonel Faris Karim, as a possible insurgent collaborator. The government cautioned that this Karim, known to U.S. intelligence operatives, may not be the same guy, but his physical description and resume were exactly the same as the Colonel Karim directing witnesses and police officers in Nasser Square on September 16, 2007. This Colonel Karim provided U.S. intelligence agents posing as Badr Corps and Jaish al-Mahdi insurgents with a steady stream of information about U.S. troop movements. But instead of turning over this watershed information, the government, wait for it, wrote summaries of the 13-year-old intelligence reports. Summaries written by the prosecutors. Where have we heard about that before? Ah, yes. When Judge Urbina and Donald Ball's attorney, Stephen McCool, excoriated them for making up lies and omitting exculpatory evidence in the grand jury proceedings. So, what were the prosecutors hiding this time? Not only did the government have this tiny problem with their lead investigator being a terrorist, Colonel Karim had publicly boasted that if he told the Iraqi witnesses to go left, they went left. If he told them to go right, they went right. That's called witness tampering, and it's a federal crime that carries prison time. Game over. Case closed. Judge Lambert didn't think so. He ruled that the prosecutor's summaries were good enough for the defense. Move along. No terrorists to see here. Here's an actor reading from his ruling.
The defendant contends that the substituted summaries are inadequate because they do not identify whether the possessing agency or agencies associated with the information with Colonel Karim in some way. But as the unclassified summaries state, the agency does not know whether these two individuals are the same person. Any further information would be neither relevant nor helpful.
Really? Not relevant or helpful? The question is, what's so secret about 13-year-old intelligence reports that the defense can't take a gander and see if the prosecutors are, again, falsifying evidence? It's not like Lambert hasn't seen this before, so either he's in on it or, as usual, asleep at the wheel. Here's Joseph Lowe, civil libertarian, NACDL member, and former Marine, to tell us what the law actually says about our constitutional right to confront our accusers. Okay, so what about witness, like being able to impeach the government's witnesses? So the example that I gave you was the man who was in charge of the investigation was an Iraqi colonel named Faris Karim. The defense did not know until the third trial that this guy had a CIA dossier. And when the defense asked for it, it was produced as summaries. They would not produce the raw intelligence, but the summaries themselves confirmed that this guy
was probably the same man who was selling information about U.S. troops to the Mahdi army and the Bada Corps. Is that important? Would that be an important, like, trial-ending violation? Like, why is it important to be able to have that?
Yes, here's why. Okay, so when it comes to witnesses, anytime a witness gets on a stand under oath and testifies, their credibility and bias is always at issue. And the issue means that it's all anything that would allow the listener, the jury, to reasonably conclude that the witness may have an agenda or may be biased against one side or may be have a credibility problem, or in other words, a liar. The jury is entitled to know that unless a judge rules via a motion that certain facts the jury cannot know for a whole list of other reasons. We'll get into later. So when you have facts that you just mentioned that go to the witness's potential credibility or bias, and in this case it would be primarily bias, but also credibility, the defense has to have that because they are entitled to bring that to the attention of the jury after that person has testified so that the jury can decide whether the person's testimony is credible or not. Just so you know, every single time I get a case where the government goes hard on his character, it tells me right away they have no evidence. And the prosecutors are trained in prosecutor school how to manipulate juries by name-calling is what I call it, so that the juries hate them and therefore do whatever they want to. It's the same way that witch hunts used to get done and how you get a people to do things they wouldn't normally do. You name-call one side so that the evolutionary trait called tribalism is switched on in their what you call reptile part of their brain, and they turn into zombies and they do, you know, what you want them to do. It's manipulative as hell, and this is what government prosecutors are trained to do.
Patrick Martin and his gang saved the worst treatment for Nick Slatin, the guy they sent to prison for life for a shot they knew he did not and physically could not have made. Remember what the father of the Kia driver said. He would not testify against Nick because the U.S. government told him that Paul Slough shot his son. The government's mission wasn't to get justice. It was to win at any cost. And to do that, Patrick Martin had to make the jury hate Nick Slatin. Here's Eddie Randall, a Raven 2-3 member who testified in all three criminal trials, talking about what it was like to watch these men get publicly torn down so that the government and the jury could rationalize what they were going to do next.
You know, Nick did nothing that the rest of us, you know, he didn't say anything that the rest of us never said. What he said, the things that he said, was just put on display for a civilian jury in Washington, D.C., without any context or any knowledge of why he would say that or, you know, what happens to people like us when we're in constant war. Everything he did, he was doing for his country, and he got prosecuted for it.
On October 22, 2014, Dustin Hurd, Evan Liberty, Paul Slough, and Nick Slatin heard the jury's verdict. Kelly Hurd, a schoolteacher, was in her classroom in Maryville, Tennessee, when Dustin called to say the jury had reached a decision.
But I was like, okay, here it goes. Yes. You know, it was more nervous butterflies. Just, this is over. Oh, there's going to be media, you know, they had been at our house before. We're going to deal with this, but it's finally going to be over. And they aren't allowed to have their cell phones, so I knew it would hit the news before I'd get a phone call. So I told my coworkers. My coworkers sat there and prayed with me, prayed for strength, prayed that the right decision would be turned over and that he would be coming home safe without any problems. And so it was getting close to this enrichment time that we had where I had very few students in my classroom. So I'm trying to keep teaching, but at the same time going over, refreshing the news button on my phone. and I refresh it, and it says guilty. And I just stared at it, and I was like, I refreshed the page again, and it says guilty. This isn't right. I refreshed it again, guilty. I go next door, and I just get out. They said they're guilty. And they just popped into motion. They said, what can we do? I said, there are kids in my room. I can't let them see me. And I was starting to lose it. It was about lunchtime, luckily. They took the kids. They took them to lunch. And they're like, Kelly, should we call your mom? And I just said, I don't know. I don't know what to do.
Every day of jury deliberations, Brian Liberty walked around the National Mall carrying his suit and waiting for Evan's lawyer, Bill Cofield, to call him and say the verdict was in. After 28 days of deliberations, his sons Evan and Aaron told him to go home to their mom, Deb. The next day, the jury came back. Aaron called to tell his dad what happened next.
They cuffed him immediately, all four of them, and led them out of the courtroom. And they stripped them and put them in their uniforms. My son Aaron tried to ask them if he could talk to Evan for a few minutes, and they denied him, which very much upset Aaron. So I think Aaron went back to try to get his suit, and of course that was gone. But they pretty much, when this came down, they were hustled right out of the courtroom by the marshals, and the marshals weren't real happy with the verdict. These marshals sat behind these guys for the whole trial, and they could be interchanged with these guys.
6 months later, on April 13th, 2015, they were sentenced. First, let's take a look at Patrick Martin's math skills, which are second only to his logic skills. Martin was pushing for sentences of 50-plus years in prison for Dustin, Evan, and Paul, and life for Nick. Here's how he justified that.
Now, as Your Honor knows, Mr. Slatton himself was found guilty of murdering Mr. Ahmad Al-Rubia. Mr. Hurd was found guilty of killing 6 individuals and attempting to kill another 11. Mr. Liberty was found guilty of killing 8 individuals and attempting to kill another 12. And Mr. Slough was found guilty of killing 13 individuals and attempting to kill another 17. All told, 14 deceased victims, 17 injured, many severely.
And they get these numbers from where? Remember, no autopsies, no bullets taken from the wounded, no photographs or ballistics evidence. So how do you assign blame for these shootings with such precision, Mr. Martin? It's a complete fantasy, and one that Judge Lamberth had no problem accepting. Why? Because the government's key witness, Jeremy Ridgway, said so. At the sentencing hearing, Dustin Hurd's attorney, David Schertler, pointed out that the government was trying to hang the Raven 2-3 men for Ridgway's deeds, while at the same time calling Ridgway a liar and a criminal.
The government remarkably invokes the specter of Mr. Ridgway, the same witness that Mr. Martin threw under the bus in his closing statement, by saying to the jury, disregard Jeremy Ridgway's testimony because he is a criminal, and he cannot be believed based upon all the lies he has told the government. Now they want to rely on his testimony. Well, he admitted pleading guilty to avoid a 30-year mandatory charge in exchange for what he believes. His lawyers are going to come in and ask you for probation. That's why he pled guilty. And when he pled guilty, he continued to lie to the government about what he did and tried to put the blame on others for a full year before the government finally pressured him into admitting what supposedly he had truly done. And then, when we see what he truly had done, It was far more egregious, far worse than anyone else in this case did.
The effect of this argument was nil, nothing. Judge Lambert sentenced Nick Slatin to a mandatory term of life in prison. He sentenced Dustin Hurd, Evan Liberty, and Paul Slough to 30 years, the mandatory minimum for using an automatic weapon to commit a felony. That charge had never been used against military contractors before. It had been codified in one of Joe Biden's crime bills to bring down drug dealers. It was especially cruel, considering the men were issued the weapons they used that day in Nasser Square by the U.S. State Department to defend the lives of other Americans. If you want to hear something to make your jaw drop, here's Judge Lambert's assessment of the men of Raven 2-3 and their actions on September 16, 2007.
There's no witness that an AK-47 was ever fired at them. It's clear that these fine young men just panicked. And it's not just a matter of panic, because they were issued these deadly weapons and entrusted with them training and guidelines that should have told them that when you fire a weapon like that, you only fire it when necessary and with due regard to the consequences of your firing.
I guess if you slept through these trials, you might believe there was no evidence that AK-47 rounds were fired. And Lambert surely knows firsthand what happens when you panic with a loaded assault rifle in your hands. In his world, and in Ridgway's, you can get off scot-free for illegally and recklessly using your weapon to spray civilians, as long as there's someone else around to take the blame for it. Interestingly, when the defense attorneys complained about the huge disparity between the 30-year sentences for their clients and the one-year term he handed Ridgway, Judge Lambert brushed them off and praised Ridgway for repeatedly lying on the stand and selling out his comrades for a deal.
You can't compare cooperators who fully come forward and agree that they did wrong, who have changed their lives. You can't compare how a court sentences them to how a court sentences your client.
Another striking thing about that first sentencing was the number of times the names Eric Prince and Blackwater came up. Eric Prince was not on trial, and yet Judge Lambert allowed the witnesses to go on and on about Prince and his political influence, his wealth and power, and his misguided attempts at checkbook diplomacy with the victims. It is completely improper for a judge to allow this. Yet it must have been easier for Judge Lambert, Patrick Martin and his team, and the jury to beat their chests and say they got justice for the Iraqi people. But these men were not Eric Prince. They were not Blackwater. Like every American, they deserved to be judged for their own actions, not on the reputation of their employer. Thankfully, the D.C. Appeals Court overturned part of Judge Lambert's ridiculous sentencing decisions the next year. The appeals court ordered Lambert to conduct a separate trial for Nick and ruled that the 30-year sentences for the gun charges for the other three men was cruel and unusual punishment. It was a hollow victory, but not surprising. Remember, Professor Richard Pierce's article, Judge Lambert's Reign of Terror at the Department of the Interior? I just love saying that title, Mike, to remind people that this judge has been committing major scale misconduct for at least two decades with complete impunity. And we soon figured out why. Shortly after we began this podcast, an anonymous tipster sent us an email addressed to Judge Lambert, D.C. Appellate Judge David Santelli, and Supreme Court Justices Roberts and Kavanaugh. This email, dated January of 2019, confirmed Judge Lambert's attendance at a monthly poker night. This poker game is held at the homes of the nation's most powerful lawyers and judges, and Judge Lambert has had a seat at that table for at least 20 years. Pierce calls this the Judges Club. It is the main reason why attorneys are afraid to report Judge Lambert's egregious illegal conduct. Here's an actor reading from Pierce's article on Judge Lambert.
Government agencies and their lawyers dare not complain about the members of the Judges Club, before whom they know they will have to appear again and again.
We were leery at first of getting crossways with this judge, because we hoped during the year we've been putting these episodes together that he'd start following the law. But after sitting in Nick Slatton's sentencing hearing last August, we decided that logic and the law mean absolutely nothing to this man. Somebody had to tell the truth about him and about the law-breaking prosecutors he enabled. The courtroom was packed with Nick's family and comrades from the 82nd Airborne in Blackwater, begging the judge for Nick's freedom. It was August 14th, 2019. Nick's attorney, Dane Butswinkus of the storied firm of Williams & Connolly, stood at the lectern before Judge Lamberth and said this about the young man he had been defending pro bono through two trials.
I would never be so presumptuous to predict how history will look at this set of cases. That's the job of the historians, not lawyers, not even the courts. But I will say this. History often sees things a little differently with the floodlight of hindsight and detachment. History has a way of slowly getting it right. My only hope is, and again, I say this respectfully, is that we won't have to wait for history to get it right. There are four eyewitnesses who had no relationship with Mr. Slatton, who said he was innocent. There was a Raven 2-3 member who admitted to this incident four times, almost contemporaneously with this incident. There was ballistics and reconstruction evidence that suggests he was innocent. There were members of the State Department who said so. The top career former FBI polygraph expert said so. And the government said so to the victim's father. So poignant that he refused, as you know, to be a part of this trial when asked.
Then came a procession of family, friends, and military comrades standing at the lectern and pleading with Lamberth to free Nicholas Slatton, an innocent man. Among them was Johnny Nunez, Nick's army comrade. Several witnesses heard the prosecutors sneeringly refer to Nunez in open court and in front of the judge as Nick's brown friend. Here's what Nunez told Judge Lamberth.
I'm Nick's brother from another mother. I'm sure you guys can see the resemblance. I'm here to share a few words in support of Nick Slatton, who was my team leader in the Army in 2005. We've been close ever since. While we were from very different backgrounds, we quickly created a bond while serving in the military. Nick is a man of character and principles who does the right thing even in the face of intense pressure. For example, during my time in the military, some of the soldiers tried to haze me. Nick prevented this. He told them that this would not happen. Even when higher-ranking soldiers tried to intervene, he pulled rank on him. He prevented it. He stood there. He stood his ground and said, "This will not happen on my watch."
These testimonials went on for 90 minutes. There was not an empty seat or a dry eye in the courtroom. Patrick Martin cowered at the prosecutor's table, his movements rabbity. He refused to look out into the gallery. The judge had pasted a thin smile on his slick, chinless face. Then came Nick's dad, Daryl Slatton. The fifth-generation Tennessee farmer and American soldier stood at the podium and addressed Judge Lamberth.
When I look at my son Nick, I see someone that this court, these prosecutors and jurors that are not here, fail to see. I see an innocent man. I see a patriot. I see a soldier and a protector of our great America. I see a man unlike many in here, including this court and the jury that are not here today, that have never been downrange, have never been in combat, and ain't got a clue. It's tough. It's tough to watch our system at work. I see a man who went to war for our country. I see a man that served two combat tours in Iraq, serving in one of America's most elite divisions, the 82nd Airborne. I see a man that watched many of his brothers be wounded and die at the hands of Iraqi insurgents, most of whom didn't even wear a uniform. One minute they were your friend, and the next minute they shot you in the back. Nick, Please accept my apologies for what your country has done to you, the country and people that you were willing to die for. I know you're innocent. This court knows you're innocent, and the jury would know you're innocent if they had been allowed to hear and see all the evidence. Rest assured, my son, rest assured, we will fight until hell freezes over to correct this total failure and travesty of justice. Nick, thanks for your service, and I love you.
Mr. Slatton's gruff eloquence caused the judge to come completely unwound. Once again, Royce Lamberth made it all about him. Rather than consider the life sentence he was about to hand down, or the family who had suffered for so long at his incompetent hands, he took exception to the existence of men of far greater valor.
The defendant's father made a statement that the court has no experience with combat. I served a year myself in Vietnam. I do know the situation in combat, and I reject the idea that I don't know what I am doing, that I don't understand combat situations. I do. And I know that it's a different situation in combat. I did serve in the General Corps, but I was in an area with the 1st Cavalry Division, where there was active combat every day in my division where I served. And I was in many situations myself that were very dangerous, but I was in a situation where we depended upon each other to carry out our orders and to ensure that innocent people were not needlessly killed. And we followed our combat rules.
What combat rules was Lamberth following when he fired like hell at nothing in the direction of a Vietnamese village filled with women and children? Judge Lamberth justified the life sentence by saying that Nick Slatton had sealed his own fate when he refused to let prosecutors refile manslaughter charges against him after they missed the filing deadline a decade earlier. When he refused to play along, they charged him with murder instead. Here's Lambert saying, essentially, you made us do it.
I agree that it's unfortunate that there is a disparity in the sentence of the other defendants. I agree that were this an ideal world, manslaughter might have been a better outcome. The defendant had the opportunity for that and turned it down and went on to gamble and take all or nothing. So he gets what he gambled for.
That's a pretty low blow, but it wasn't enough for Lamberth. He knew he was putting an innocent man behind bars for life. He actually compared the Nisser Square shootings to the Boston Massacre. It would have been laughable had it not been so frightening to watch a federal judge take leave of reality.
History will not be so kind to Nicholas Slatton. And unlike the British soldiers, 2 centuries and a half a world apart, Slatton and his teammates shot without any provocation.
Do we really have to say this again? The prosecution, defense, and appellate court all agree at this point that Raven 2-3 was fired upon by insurgents. Too little, too late. But those are the facts about the Nisser Square incident to everyone involved in the case, except Judge Lamberth. So what was Nick's reaction to this final indignity? He forgave Judge Lamberth. Here were his last words to the court.
Does the truth matter? The members of my jury have never been to combat, so there was no way for me to get a fair trial, especially when prosecutors and key witnesses were allowed to lie to my jury. This is a miscarriage that I will not stand. Judge, you know I am innocent. I am asking you to throw out this case. If you don't, Judge, I forgive you for killing me for something I did not do. May the Lord bless you, sir.
Lamberth could not look Nick in the face as he handed down the sentence. Life in prison. He stuck to the script he had decided upon when he first reached out and grabbed this high-profile case from Judge Leon. For one last moment in the spotlight, just like Richard Pierce pointed out in his scholarly paper, Judge Lamberth's reign of terror. Judge Lamberth invented his own reality and stuck to it in spite of the facts. Here's an actor reading from Judge Lamberth's words from the sentencing transcript.
At the same time, I have to reject the statements that the defendant himself makes that he is innocent. The court's own view of the evidence is the same as that of the jury, that in fact, the defendant committed this offense. The defendant is guilty of this offense. The defendant, in fact, committed this crime and fired this shot into the white Kia and shot the decedent, Ahmed Al-Rubia, between the eyes and killed him before that car ever moved forward. That the statements of Mr. Slough that he did it were fictitious and were in an effort to mislead authorities and were never true and did not constitute the truth of the matter and were in an effort to mislead authorities at the time as to what was going on. And the court is in full agreement that the defendant is in fact guilty.
4 weeks later, at a resentencing hearing for Paul Slough, Dustin Hurd, and Evan Liberty, Judge Lamberth again made it all about himself. He went on another tirade about a letter sent to him by a group of Texas lawmakers urging him to sentence the men to time served because they're innocent and because the trial was so obviously rigged to appease the Iraqi government.
Again, I have to totally reject any notion that my sentence in this case is to appease an ally, as the congressmen and senators are raising me with in the letter yesterday. I am not here to appease an ally.
In one of the most heartbreaking moments of the sentencing, Paul Slough rose to address the court and to apologize for shooting Ahmed Haitham Al-Rubia, the driver of the white Kia. Here's an actor reading from the transcript.
Your Honor, this time and this experience has been crushing, and I am beyond horrified that innocent life was taken that day. Your Honor, I take full acceptance for my own actions, and I thank God for his providence that Mr. Rubia knows who I am and that someday I might find forgiveness in his eyes, and the two of us may indeed be healed. Your Honor, by God's grace, I too am a father and a son, a brother and a husband and an uncle. And it is crippling to even consider losing my wife, our daughter, my parents, my in-laws, my brothers and sisters, and their siblings. But just as crushing and horrifying and crippling, Your Honor, is being forever branded with this loss of life.
Lamberth's big beef, and supposedly the reason that Jeremy Ridgway had spent just 6 months in prison, was that the other Raven 23 men had not exhibited sufficient guilt and remorse for the gun battle with the insurgency. The judge and the gormless Patrick Martin had a touching moment at the resentencing where they marveled at how Ridgway had turned his life around, in his luxury home in California, not working full-time, but devoting himself to charity. Nice work if you can get it. Even though Dustin and Evan followed Paul in expressing their regret for the loss of lives, Lamberth rejected their request for a sentence of time served. That's 7 years of virtual imprisonment while the DOJ screwed around trying to get this case off the ground, and 5.5 years of actual prison time. Here's what His Honor said.
First and foremost, I squarely reject any notion that there is any question as to the factual guilt of each of the three defendants. Each of these defendants was found guilty by a jury after a fair trial that I conducted. There is a message, though, that this court in sentencing does consider, and that is, what kind of country is the United States? We hold our armed forces and our contractors accountable for their actions. We did in cases I worked on in Vietnam, sometimes as a defense attorney. We believe in the rule of law in our country. We believed it in Vietnam, and we believed it in Iraq. And our courts try to enforce the rule of law. And I believe, as a judge, my duty is to enforce the rule of law.
And he brings it right back to himself yet again. Instead of time served, Lamberth sentenced Dustin Hurd to 12 years in prison, Evan Liberty to 14 years, and Paul Slough to 15 years. Martin and his prosecutors must have thought they were home free. But 2 days after Mike and I appeared on Fox News talking about the case, a whistleblower stepped up and blew the government's case apart again. This person turned over Army documents proving that the government's two main witnesses had flatly lied on the stand, and that Martin and his team knew about it and may have encouraged it. That is a federal crime. The witnesses, Matt Murphy and Jeremy Ridgway, had portrayed Nick Slatton as a racist thug who was spoiling for a fight against Iraqis, that he had a history of taking potshots at Iraqis and encouraged others to do the same. They accused him of setting off a gun battle with Iraqis a week before the Nisr Square incident. The problem was, that Army report, the one the government hid from Nick's lawyers, showed something very different. The Army officers at the scene said they were under fire before the Blackwater team arrived, and that Nick Slatton had absolutely nothing to do with how it all started. At the trials, prosecutor Patrick Martin argued that this earlier incident showed that Nick indiscriminately shot his weapon without regard for who might be struck by the rounds. According to Martin, Nick fired at a person in the building who was not a threat for the express purpose of starting a firefight, and that he brought lethal force to bear when it was not authorized, when there was no provocation. At trial, Murphy said Slatton fired first. But in 2007, he said he saw the Army already engaged in a firefight when he and Nick arrived. In their motion for a new trial, Nick's lawyers argued that the government urged the jury to conclude that Mr. Slatton had premeditated Nisr Square because he had done this previously. And Patrick Martin even urged the jury to blame Nick for all the shots that followed on the inflammatory theory that he had intended to start a massive shooting. Judge Lamberth was so taken with Martin's theory that he denied Nick's motion for acquittal, saying that Nick fired without provocation on multiple occasions and openly encouraged teammates to shoot innocuous targets. Huh? I guess he was sleeping through the part where we all found out that Murphy and Ridgway lied about that. Predictably, Lamberth also denied Nick's motion for a new trial, saying that the lies told by Ridgway and Murphy and condoned by Patrick Martin were inconsequential to the government's case. Every single one of the government's key witnesses, Monum, Kareem, Ridgway, and Murphy, and the Iraqis that Kareem directed to go left or go right, had either lied on the stand or had major credibility problems. And this is what Lamberth had to say about the litany of willful errors.
Although there were mistakes made along the way by the government, by and large, the government found and exposed and delivered to the world a trial where the truth of what happened in Nassau Square came out, and there for the world and the public to see. And I think the government of the United States deserves great credit for the truth came out in this case and this trial.
To be fair, there were some winners. On October 21st, 2015, Attorney General Loretta Lynch presented awards to a very special team of prosecutors. The DOJ lauded its Blackwater team in a special press release that also described the promotions of T. Patrick Martin, Jonathan Malice, Greg Mazel, Kenneth Cole, Jay Bryant, John Crabb, Christopher Kavanaugh, David Mudd, and Yvonne Bryant. Here's what Attorney General Lynch said about the individuals that the National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers described variously as vindictive, incompetent, and unethical violators of the U.S. Constitution.
The individuals being honored today stand out within a department that holds all of its employees and partners to an extremely high standard of excellence. And their outstanding work is an inspiration to public servants everywhere.
On December 22, 2020, President Donald Trump pardoned the men of Raven 2-3. Full and unconditional pardons. I think that says it all. Raven 2-3 is a production of Think Again Studios. It was written by Gina Keating and Michael Flaherty. Our producers are Ashton Smith, Gina Keating, and Michael Flaherty. Executive producers are Chai Ling, Lindsay Fellows, and Valerie McGowan. Mitchell Weinbaum edited this episode. Mitchell also serves as our associate producer along with Kyle Hartford and Tina Graff. Our actors are Elizabeth Benz, Kurt Brinkman, Jonathan Compton, Paul Keegan, Barry Leibowitz, Jaden Marquez, Kevin Miller, and Ebony Evelyn Joyce Williams. Lindsay Fellows and Aaron Fullen supervise the music. Our theme song is performed by Chloe Caroline. Thanks to Anne and Neil Corkery for their kindness and generosity. Finally, we owe a debt to our men and women in uniform. Thank you for defending our freedom so that others may one day enjoy them as well. For more information about this podcast, go to thinkagain.me. There you can find additional research and primary resources regarding the case of Raven 2-3. You can learn about future episodes and receive updates as events continue to evolve. You can also learn more about our future projects as well as award-winning films, music, and books created by our team. And consider supporting us on Patreon or rating us on Apple Podcasts. Thanks to everyone who donated so much of your time and talent to this passion project.